Hi there. Thanks for joining us on Chicago Tonight. I'm Brandis Friedman.
And I'm Paris Schutz. Here's what we're looking at.
5 years ago, I was made aware of the upcoming renegotiation of the franchise agreement between ComEd and the city by Alderman Rosa.
A local resident says they were politically targeted after speaking at this week's city council meeting.
A new report on why homicides involving black men are solved less than any other racial ethnic group.
Once he made the announcement he was coming to the city of Chicago, I had to do something.
On this first week of Black History Month, we revisit what it was like to participate in Martin Luther King Jr.'s historic Marquette Park March.
What I liked about it is that house music and dance music always represented love.
And we check in with a Chicago Grammy-nominated producer ahead of Sunday's award show.
And now some of today's top stories. Senator Dick Durbin is calling for gun dealers to do more to prevent guns from being stolen. He highlighted his legislation alongside Highland Park Mayor Nancy Rotering during National Gun Violence Survivors Week, which runs through Tuesday. That marks the approximate time each year that gun deaths in the U.S. surpass those experienced in other countries in an entire year.
America's gun death rate is 13 times greater than our peer nations. Every day in the U.S., on average, 110 people are shot and killed. More than 200 people survive gunshot wounds. And countless others are traumatized by acts of gun violence. In Highland Park's case, thousands.
Durbin, along with U.S. Representative Brad Schneider, discussed their Secure Firearms Storage Act, which they introduced in Congress last week. They say the bill would require federally licensed gun dealers to securely store all firearms when they're closed to prevent them from being stolen. Durbin pointed to a 2021 Chicago Tribune investigation on one stolen gun in Wisconsin that had been linked to 27 different shootings in Chicago.
Up in the sky, it's a bird, it's a plane. According to U.S. defense officials, it's actually a Chinese surveillance balloon. The object was spotted in the sky above states like Montana and Kansas, reportedly moving eastward. U.S. state and defense officials say they don't have plans to shoot it down at this point because they say it doesn't pose a security threat to anyone. And given its size, the debris could cause a lot of damage if it were to fall from the sky. Illinois Congressman Roger Krishnamoorthy is on the House Intelligence Committee and says he believes China should face consequences.
The Chinese Communist Party has long posed a technological, economic, and military threat, and we're just seeing the latest evidence of this right now, and we have to counter it on a bipartisan basis, and we should avoid partisanship on this particular issue.
I was looking to see if it was over Chicago today, but I think it was just an airplane. The U.S. economy added a big number of jobs last month, 517,000. That brings the unemployment rate to a 53-year low of 3.4%. Economists had only predicted 185,000 jobs, but the report from the Bureau of Labor Statistics suggests a possible deviation in the long-standing connection between jobs and inflation. The inflation number fell to 6.5% in December from its peak over 9% last summer.
The school lunchroom could be getting a bit healthier. Federal agricultural officials proposed new nutrition standards for school meals focusing on limiting added sugars. That means items like cereals, flavored milk, and pastries would be limited in how much added sugar they could contain. The plan also aims to reduce sodium in school meals by 30%.
If it snows again this winter, you can bet the plow will be out there clearing city streets. The plow is the name that got the number one vote getter out of seven in the city's snow plow naming contest. Chicagoans submitted 7,000 names in all in the contest. Officials whittled them down to 50 finalists, and 80,000 votes came up. Some of those finalists were Mrs. O'Leary's Plow, Da Plow, Jean-Baptiste Point Du Shovel, Sears Plower, Sleet Home Chicago, Holy Plow, and Salter Payton. I would bet that that one was the fastest plow. Signs will be installed on seven plows, and you can follow their progress on the city's plow tracker site. And coming up in the program, racial disparities in CPD's homicide clearance rate and the impact on victims' families.
But first, a resident says they're being politically targeted for speaking out against the city's ComEd deal. Heather Sharone with that story right after this.
Chicago Tonight is made possible in part by Alexandra and John Nichols, the Jim and Kay Mabee family, the Polk Brothers Foundation, and the support of these donors.
A Chicago resident and public speaker was ejected at Wednesday city council meeting without appearing to have violated any rules. Now they wonder if it was retaliation from the mayor, and city officials are demanding answers. WTTW News reporter Heather Sharon joins us now with a look at this incident. So, Heather, the person we're talking about here, Sean Estelle, one of the leaders of the efforts to convince city officials to cut ties with ComEd and form its own utility. So let's listen to what Estelle told city council about this deal that Mayor Lori Lightfoot brokered.
Fast forward to today when we have a mayoral candidate flagging in the polls, flailing for solid political ground to stand on, who has not only ceded the red lines that she put forward in back rooms with corrupt ComEd leadership, but also has put forward a draft franchise agreement that spits in the face of demands put forward by the Democratized ComEd campaign and our aldermanic champions.
Heather, who removed Estelle from the meeting after those remarks, and what were the reasons that they gave?
Well, they were removed by Chicago police officers who were, they said, acting at the request of the sergeant-at-arms, who is responsible for security in the city council chamber. The sergeant-at-arms reports to Alderman Michelle Harris, who is the close Lightfoot ally who's in charge of the Rules Committee. However, Alderman Harris told me that she and her staff had nothing to do with the decision to remove Estelle from the city council chambers, so it's unclear who ordered the police officers to act.
And to be clear, you were there, and there's tape of this whole meeting. It doesn't appear anywhere in this tape that Estelle violated any of the rules here. So how did Estelle react?
Well, they were scared at first and then angry because they have been a leader in the DSA campaign to cut ties with ComEd and have the city form its own municipal utility. They were unable to watch the raucous debate that erupted when Mayor Lightfoot introduced this deal, and that was very disappointing.
DSA campaign, Democratic Socialist of America, the Chicago chapter. They're a political group here with prominence in Chicago. So what explanation did you get from the mayor's office and the Chicago Police Department?
I have gotten no explanation from the mayor's office or the Chicago Police Department, despite repeated requests for comment, and that has led Estelle and the Democratic Socialists of America to conclude that it is nothing but pure political retaliation.
And let's remind viewers that these city council meetings are all public and residents have a right to come voice their opinion in the beginning portion of this. So is this possibly a First Amendment issue?
Well, if they were removed because of the political speech that they engaged in, it would be a First Amendment violation and a violation of the city council's rules of procedure. Now, that is what members of the city council wants to know, and that's why they've asked Inspector General Deborah Witzberg to investigate.
All right, Heather, I know you'll follow this.
I sure will. Thanks, Paris.
You bet. And you can read Heather's full story on our website. That's WTTW.com/news. Up next, why homicides involving black men are solved less than any other racial group. Stay with us.
What should the city be doing to better support black Chicagoans who are victims and survivors of hate crimes?
Classic city of Chicago. We work in silos, so the left hand doesn't know what the right hand doing, and the constituents get left out in between.
Power is the voice. The power is the numbers. The power are the people. The ability to sway election is the power.
For the past several years, the Chicago Police Department has solved an average of 50% of the city's homicides per year. But that number, known as a clearance rate, for black victims is even lower. That's according to Live Free Chicago, which says this failure to solve homicides is itself a root cause of violence. Joining us with more is Artenise Myrick, the lead Chicago organizer with Live Free Chicago. We also reached out to the Chicago Police Department. They sent us a statement, which we will get to in just a moment. Artenise, welcome back. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So first, let's define what a clearance rate is. What is that?
A clearance rate is the rate in which law enforcement solves homicides. And so that equation looks like the amount of homicides that are cleared through arrest or prosecution divided by the number of total homicides that happen within a year.
There are two ways for homicide to be cleared, you all write in your report, either through prosecution or exceptional means. What is the difference?
Absolutely. So prosecution is the state's attorney actually charging someone for a homicide, where exceptional means is a clearance term used by law enforcement to explain that they've cleared a case to circumstances that weren't in their control. So this could be due to a person that they found as a suspect for the case dying, or because it's been barred to prosecution, which means that the state's attorney did not determine that there was a sufficient enough evidence to be able to prosecute someone.
In 2021, homicide clearance rates by prosecution were 21.7% in predominantly black neighborhoods. 45.6% in predominantly white neighborhoods. What would you say is driving this disparity?
I think it's the lack of trust within community and law enforcement, right? And the lack of care that is given to black communities when dealing with homicides. And I think even the way that they're clearing the cases has to do with that, right? When you're clearing a lot of cases by exceptional means, it means that we don't have enough evidence. We're not going and doing the procedural things that we need to do to make sure that these things are seen through, but not, and also that in white neighborhoods, they may have those resources and those connections to do that appropriately.
Is it possible that someone could make the argument that the case load in some communities is so heavy that it is difficult to prosecute?
Absolutely. I think that is an argument, right? And I think one portion of it is we need to look at how this process looks, right? We can have tons of patrol officers who are coming in and adding to the chaos within black neighborhoods. But if we don't have enough detectives who are specialized to look at this information and be able to determine the right people who need to be held responsible, then you're going to look at high caseloads. If you don't have enough infrastructure to be able to take in what's needed to be taken care of, then you're going to look at disparities and crisis happen. And I think even more specifically that a lot of other police departments, they have civilian people who are working within investigations, looking into evidence and things of that nature. And CPD does not have that same civilian infrastructure. So how do we start building up that infrastructure so that it's salient to what the cause and the issues are?
As I mentioned, Chicago Police Department did send us a statement. It reads in part, quote, "The Chicago Police Department's detectives work around the clock to identify and apprehend those responsible for senseless violence in our communities. All homicides are thoroughly investigated as we work to seek justice for every single victim and their families. While these investigations can often take time, based on the evidence available and the complexities of each case, our detectives remain committed to solving these cases and bringing a small measure of peace to the families who have lost loved ones." Artenise, from your research, what's the reaction you've heard from families who say they are not getting this closure from police officers?
Absolutely. I think families impacted by gun violence, especially in the black community, are in the intersection of being over-policed and under-protected. And so when police officers are coming into families, communities, homes, they're not treating these loved ones with care. In fact, they're telling them to go out and find the information themselves, to go out and investigate themselves. And they don't have the answers. They don't have the skills equipped to be able to go do what detectives are doing. And in fact, that's what they're funded to do, right? And so a lot of families are feeling like they're the ones being criminalized while also seeking closure during homicide cases.
Your report also points to the disparity in homicide clearance rates where victims are, where the women are the victims. Since 2001, the unsolved homicides for black women is at 35% compared to 23% for white women. Your report also talks about something called the perfect victim narrative. What is that?
Absolutely. It's the narrative in which that people who are impacted by gun violence or victims of gun violence have to be perfect, right? That any blemish in their past or in their story could then deem them as less worthy of having the case solved, less worthy of having that case solved. And then those blemishes that deem them less worthy are characteristics that a lot of people in impoverished neighborhoods have on their records or have in their backgrounds. And so again, it's unrealistic. And every individual, every family deserves the closure, the intention, and the care when dealing with homicides.
How is the failure to solve any of these homicides, not just those for women, but how is that in and of itself a root cause of violence?
It perpetuates the violence. If someone can get away with murder 85% of the time, it just elicits that there's no one taking care of this issue, that there's no one there, right? And for us, we're not calling for carceral strategies. However, we're calling for closure for families. We're also just saying that this process is not transparent. We're looking to see what exactly is the police budget going towards, right? If their efficacy isn't proven, then a lot of programs get cut. They get underfunded. They get eliminated, right? And so those are some of the disparities that we're seeing that also perpetuates the violence, and that communities feel like, hey, I need to take this into my own hands because the people here to do it aren't.
A couple of seconds left. What would you say needs to change in the police's approach?
I think there needs to be more of a civilian infrastructure. There needs to be people who are from the communities that are greatly impacted who are able to go in and handle evidence the day that an incident happens, and people who are able and willing to handle the families, the cases with care from the incident all the way to prosecution. And
go ahead.
And just looking at how do we begin to start looking at investment to these communities on the front end? How do we make sure that we already have the proactive resources and accessibility to those resources to be able to get families like what they need, like mental health care, trauma care? Because, again, gun violence is huge in these communities. And so the healing that is needed to be a solution for that problem is huge. And so I think people who are from these communities can really help. To help us solve this issue.
All right, Denise Myrick, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And there's more Chicago Tonight just ahead, but first, a look at the weather.
This week is the start of Black History Month, and Chicago certainly has a big part to play in that history. The Chicago Lawn is known for its diversity, but it was a different story 50 years ago. Chicago Tonight's Joanna Hernandez and producer Blair Paddock spent time in the Southwest Side community to explore Martin Luther King's work in the area.
Barbara Miller was in her early 20s when she heard Martin Luther King Jr. was coming to Chicago.
I had to do something, and I'd already seen all the marches that he had done, so it was my opportunity.
On August 5th, 1966, Miller was one of the hundreds who marched alongside Dr. King, protesting housing segregation on the southwest side of Chicago, a time when realtors refused to sell homes in white neighborhoods to African-American families.
Describe to me, what was it like?
There was a lot of excitement in the crowd. There was a lot of anxiety in the crowd, and I was, you know, feeling that kind of anxiety and excitement. But once we were in a situation where there were throngs of people on the sides of us, yelling and screaming and calling us names and telling us to get out of their neighborhood and throwing things, rocks, bottles.
Chaos erupted as marchers walked towards Marquette Park. Along the way, Dr. King was hit by a rock.
This is a terrible thing. I've been in many demonstrations all across the South, but I can say that I have never seen, even in Mississippi and Alabama, mobs as hostile and as hate-filled as I've seen in Chicago.
The march was part of a bigger movement, one that historian Jim Rolfe has followed.
Chicago is a segregated city. There were lines drawn. And what the Chicago Freedom Movement and Dr. King were trying to do was open up the city and open up the metropolitan area.
On the corner of Marquette Road and Kedzie Avenue, inside Marquette Park, stands a memorial honoring not only Dr. King's legacy, but those who fought for racial equality.
I love revisiting the MLK Living Memorial. It's a wonderful tribute to the people, the community, Martin Luther King Jr. and the Fair Housing Marches, especially because his birthday, a very significant date, is coming up. It's a wonderful time to reflect.
It's been 6 years since artists Sonia Henderson and Jot Pittman Weber created the three-pillar sculptures. Henderson says they want people to find a spiritual connection when they visit.
First of all, when you walk up the sidewalk, it takes you immediately into the procession and you start circling around to see all of the tableaus. And when you come in, you're actually met by the protest scenes. There's actually, at the bottom, you can see King and Coretta, who actually wasn't here for these particular marches, but I did sculpt her shoes, and you can see the bottoms of their legs, and then there's arm in arm, and then there's protest signs. And then the next tableau is King getting struck by a rock, and the Meatpackers Union were there to protect him, and they're pushing him down and swaddling him.
A reminder of the past that Rolfe says needs more attention.
The spirit of the Chicago Freedom Movement, I think, is a spirit that should be embraced by more Chicagoans. And there should be study and recognition of what happened here so we can learn from it and we can move forward. Because Chicago's dream was, Martin Luther King's dream for Chicago was a city of people coming together, a city of brotherhood.
The neighborhood's demographics have since changed. Yet Miller says she can't forget the events that took place here more than 50 years ago.
It's almost a miraculous situation because you realize how hard they fought to try to keep a neighborhood that they could have just shared. It's a neighborhood I couldn't have walked through.
Holding on to the vision of Martin Luther King Jr.'s movement.
It saddens me that he had to die in such a violent way, but I still know that he set the country on a path and that the dream will be realized, and I expect it in my lifetime.
For Chicago Tonight, I'm Joanna Hernandez.
You can find out more about Marquette Park on our website. Brandis.
Paris, the 65th annual Grammy Awards are this Sunday, and a local Chicagoan is up for an award that celebrates a music style that originated in Chicago. Arts correspondent Angel Ito introduces us to producer Terry Hunter, who breaks down the music genre he used to remix Beyoncé's Break My Soul.
Yo, it's so funny. How do you describe house music? That's been the ongoing statement for 30 years. Just deafening the feeling.
House is me. House is WMC. Mikasa House in a Park, Chosen Few Festival.
Now, it might be covered in snow now, but in the summer months, Jackson Park is home to one of Chicago's biggest house music festivals, the Chosen Few Picnic.
The music genre that's moved the city for decades and where Chicago producer and Chosen Few DJ Terry Hunter found his love for making music.
I found my niche in it just from how house made you feel, how disco music made you feel. How house came about is that we, as kids, we wasn't musicians, you know, so we didn't know how to play the keyboards. And so what we did was just interpolated what we heard from the older disco record.
Hunter's interpretation as a DJ would lead him to produce music around the world.
DJing is my first love. What made my production skills great is my ear and my experience for being a DJ, to know how to read a crowd. So then putting that into my productions and hopefully get the same response.
It was when sharing some music he'd recently produced on a live stream that Hunter received the call to remix a new song for Beyoncé.
I was like, yeah, bro, I'm kind of a busy break my Beyoncé. Hell yeah. They end up sending me the session, and I worked on it that night and sent it to him, and he called me back and was like, they love it. And she could have went to anybody else. She came to the source. She came back to Chicago. So I have nothing but love and respect for her for doing that.
And as he waited for the official approval from Beyoncé's camp, Hunter decided to share his house take while mixing at the Chosen Few Picnic last summer.
Still wasn't out yet. We still didn't know what was going on. And I played the record at the picnic and broke it, and it went nuts. Even after that, it still didn't come out, I don't think, until a month later. When I got my first Grammy nod with Jennifer Hudson, we lost to Beyoncé. So, talk about full circle. Now I'm nominated with Beyoncé. So, I'm claiming it. We're going to bring it home. But win, lose, or draw, I feel like the Terry Hunter brand and Team Terry Hunter chose a few more. You hear some of that organ, how rich it is. So I just want people to feel my music and just be able to understand and know that this is not a computer-generated sound. This is something coming from someone's inside, someone's soul, something that you can't really explain. But when you hear it, like house music, you know it makes you feel some type of way. Break My Soul, Beyoncé, Terry Hunter remix. Grammy Award winning.
For Chicago Tonight, I'm Angel Ito.
Boom.
Boom. The 65th Annual Grammy Awards are happening this Sunday.
All right, Good luck to him, of course.
That is our show for this Friday night. Don't forget to stay connected with us by signing up for our daily briefing. And you can get Chicago Tonight streamed on Facebook, YouTube, and our website, WTTW.com/news.
You can also get the show via podcast and the PBS video app. And join us tomorrow night at 6 for Chicago Tonight Latino Voices. Eliminating confusion on government forms, the Biden administration proposes changes to the race and ethnicity boxes on the census and other documents.
And then at 6:30 tomorrow on Chicago Tonight, Black Voices, what's in the AP African American Studies course that Florida has already banned from its schools? Now for all of us here at Chicago Tonight, I'm Brandis Friedman.
And I'm Paris Schutz. Thank you for watching. Have a great weekend.
Closed captioning is made possible by Robert A. Clifford and Clifford Law Offices, a Chicago personal injury and wrongful death firm that is proud to be a multilingual law firm that provides translators for a variety of languages.